Good morning, everyone. Anteruan sarnai. How are you all feeling this morning? Good? Very good. That makes my life easier. So I don't have much to do then if you're feeling good. What are you here for? If you're feeling good, you should be at home. I thought you come here to learn how to be good. I know you're all good, but you're here to be better, right? Better than good? The best you can be? You're good now, but then there are some times when you're not so good, huh? Yes. We all have those days when we are not so good. Good days and bad days. So we're here to learn how to be better than good, how to be the best that we can be, and how to make the most of our valuable lives. So, let's make a start then. And to do that, let us all first take a moment to pay homage to the most magnificent one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one, the infinitely compassionate one. He is our master, he is our teacher, he is our guide, he who went all the way to discover the path to deliverance, not just for himself, but for all sentient beings. And it is in his footsteps today we tread, on our path to liberation, seeking ultimate happiness and freedom from all suffering. So therefore, as we do that, let us also remind ourselves that we must take a promise to ourselves. We must make a promise to ourselves. This is an oath that we take, a pledge. We pledge our allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem, not because it is the nice thing to do, the good thing to do, but that is because it is the only refuge that we have. So with that in mind, let us all take a moment to pay homage to the Noble Triple Gem, seek refuge, as well as to observe the precepts before we begin today's proceedings. All right.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Doctor's orders are not to speak. But then if I did that, how are you going to spend the rest of your week? So I try and speak as little as possible, which is not at all possible. So that I can come and speak to you on Sunday. Because if you lived close to the monastery, you could come every so often. You could visit one of our monks or one of our Anagarika Mahatmyas if you have any problems you want to discuss with them. And they'd be able to help you as well. But it is not convenient or practical for now. So therefore, these sermons have to continue. Because I understand more than you for now the value of noble companionship. It's what the mind associates with, the mind becomes. Simple as that, ladies and gentlemen. Remember the two parrots? One fell with the hermits, the other fell with the burglars. Association. You are who you are today because of your associations. Show me the five people you spend most of your time with, and I'll give you A to Z about you. You don't even have to come and talk to me. Without speaking a word with you, I can tell you everything about you if only I spent some time talking to the five people that you spend most of your time with. I'll find out who they are and then I'll tell you who you are. That is not something special. It's not a special gift or a skill that I have. That is just the way it is. The mind becomes what it thinks. So what do you think? You think what your environment gets you to think, right? So why are people always going on about how young children spend far too much time playing computer games, far too much time watching films, far too much time watching Superman? Do you remember when you were younger? I don't know, did you have Superman when you were younger? Superman was just making a debut when I was younger. Remember what you wanted to do after you watched Superman? You got the curtain or a bed sheet or maybe one of Mama's saris. No, you draped it around your neck and then got on a couch or something. Maybe climbed up a ladder and then you were lucky that some adult was where you were and said, "Puta, get down, get down, get down." Because when you see what Superman does, you want to do what Superman does. When we were younger, we want to do what our adults did, right? What our parents did. You had a pair of slippers, but so did your father. Which one made you happier? Getting into which pair? Not yours. It made you happy to get into your father's. Because we are always a product of our environment. We just need to get out of this thinking that we have free will. It's time you got out of that. You know, if that was the case, advertising would have nothing to do. If you thought and you decided and you did what you wanted to do, then advertising has no part to play. Why is advertising such a big business? How come advertising is such a big business? They make a lot of money, and a lot of money also goes into investing, into further developing advertising strategies, right? And they study psychology. Why do they study psychology? Because through studying psychology, they know how to change the psyche. That is what they do. You're influenced all the time by your environment. You speak like the people you're surrounded with. You know, just sometimes, you know, if you have the chance, sometimes you go into the slums. Right, like on occasions we go on Pindapatha, right? They speak a very different language to what you do. When you see a Swaminuhanse and how you speak to a Swaminuhanse, or you know, to each other, right? When we bump into each other on the street, right? The way we talk to others, it's very different there in the slums. Is that because you're good and they're bad? Environment. Environment. Why are you so cautious about the people that your children spend their time with? Why are you always so careful about and vigilant about your children's friends? Aren't you, as parents? You're always so mindful about that. Who do you spend your time with? Who's your best friend? What do they do? What do their parents do? What are some of the things that he says? Like your child comes home one day and he starts using some swear words. What's the first thing you're going to do as a mother? You go to the school, won't you? You go to the school, you speak to the principal, you speak to the teacher and ask him, "Madam, my child doesn't speak like this normally. Because we don't speak like this at home." See? That is your rationale. We don't speak like this at home, so my child doesn't normally use this kind of language. So what are you again confirming? My child is the product of the environment. So how come after he started schooling, he started picking up these bad words, this foul language? I remember I learned my first swear word when I was in grade 6. Who do you think I learned it from? My mother. Where did you learn all the swear words you know today from? Oliver Twist? No. You learnt it from your buddies, your friends at school. Who interested you in pornography? Your friends from school. They're the ones who said, I have a site. You have internet home at home, right? This is website. Go on it. That's where you picked it up, from school. School, tuition, class, environment. But the effect that it had sometimes would last a lifetime. See, it's so easy. You know, it takes a second, a split second, to get one into a drishti. We talked about drishti last week. It takes a split second for you to be convinced that something is nice, something is pleasurable. But it takes you sometimes more than a lifetime to get out of it. Remember the first smoke you took? If any of you smoke, or at least used to smoke and then gave it up. Which one was harder, getting into it or getting out of it? I dropped my case. Perhaps if you used to drink a little bit too much, which one was harder, getting into it or getting out of it? You know. Which one's harder, getting addicted to television or getting out of it? Computer games? Parents, you'll know this. The time that you have, or the really difficult time you have with trying to get your children to stop doing it. But getting them into it was so easy. All you had to do was sit them next to someone who used to play computer games. That's it. That's why you are a product of your environment. So please get out of this thinking that I rule my life. You don't. You don't. The brand of bread you have is determined by your environment. You have a favorite brand of bread, right? When you go to the supermarket, you walk down the aisles and you go down to the right bread and you pick that. And you think, see, I have free choice. There are lots of choices and I make my choice. In fact, one of the reasons that they have lots of different makes, sometimes all from the same company, is so that they can fool you to think that you have free choice. Ha ha ha, gotcha. The same company will make 3 brands of soap. Sometimes more, no less. All used for the same thing. All used to become fairer. Or to smell nice. Or for a supple skin. All for the same purpose. But they'll come in 3 brands. So that when you walk into the supermarket and you see all 3 brands laid out, you get this feeling that you have chosen. But really, it is not you who has chosen. And regardless, it matters not which one you choose, they've made their profit. I'm not speaking against them, by the way. We never have a bone to pick with the world. Never. And even if everyone out there was vile and vicious and all they wanted to do was to exploit you, right, and dry you out of every dime that you have in your pocket, I wouldn't have a problem with them. Because we are not here to fix the world. We are only here to fix minds that want to be fixed. That's it. I'm a garage. If you want to get your car fixed, bring it here. I'm not a traveling garage man. This is the garage. If you want your car fixed, bring it here. But I don't go covering potholes on the roads. I don't go clearing the roads and, you know, checking if there are any pebbles on the road or any stones on the road, which if you drive over, it's going to damage your car, right, or chip the paint. I'm not going to go do that. That is not the job of the Mahasangha. The police will do that. Law enforcement agencies will do that. That's not our task. Our task is to help those who wish to be helped. So therefore, this is the garage. Come all ye who are broken, and we will have you fixed. Christ said something similar. Come all ye who are weary and burdened, and I will set you free. So that is why I come here. I made that promise even at the monastery. If I'm alive and my heart beats and I can speak, I will be there on the Dharmasana, as long as at least there's one of you in the audience. Because I don't have much faith in the devas. They may come, they may not come. You know, they don't make their presence known. So I don't want to waste my breath in case they've got other things to do. Plenty of times in the scriptures we see, right? In the Tripitaka, the devas, they come and meet the Buddha. They come to the Buddha and say, Venerable Sir, I have come to you for some counsel. I have come to you for some advice. And the Buddha gives him advice. And after a while they say, Venerable Sir, we are devas. We have lots of things to attend to. We are far too busy to be spending the rest of the day with you. So we must make our leave. And so then they leave. On some occasions the Buddha says, if he had stayed for a minute longer, if he'd stayed for a bit longer, he would have realized the Dhamma. But he's far too busy. You're not like that, are you? You're not too busy to sort yourselves out, are you? But noble companionship is everything. Everything. If there's one thing I could say that would be conducive to Nibbana, just one thing, right? You know the precepts, you know the practice, you know becoming a monk, right? All of these things support. But if you ask me to give you one reason, one thing, just one thing, that is most supportive and conducive to your attaining Nibbana, I would say that is noble companionship. And the Buddha has confirmed this. Ananda, what you have said is not right. You have just said that half of the Buddha Sasana is dependent on a noble companion, and that is not right, Ananda. So do not utter those words again. The entirety of the Buddha Sasana is dependent on noble companionship. What is noble companionship? It is not the sight of someone. That will help. But true sight is insight. That you have to see through your mind, through your wisdom eye. See, I can come here and sit here all day long, perhaps even in meditative pose, right? And you can be so utterly impressed. And you'll get up and you'll walk away. Perhaps you'll even bring me alms and say, wow, that Swaminivas is so virtuous, he won't even bat an eyelid. From the moment he walked into this room, he sat in meditation pose, right? He must have developed his faculties so much, right? And what good does that do to you? You can offer some alms and earn some merits, yes. But you are the same way you started. For some change to happen within you, ladies and gentlemen, you need to hear the Dhamma. It must go through your ears. It must leave an impression on the soft spot between the two ears. That's when that change will begin to happen for you. And for that, you need to hear these words. And if the only way that those words can be heard is when I speak them out, then I have to speak them out. It's so unfortunate that it is that way. What if I could just speak to your mind? Wouldn't that be nice? You don't even have to come here then. Just wake up at whatever time you wake up at in the morning, and you can all be at home. Right? I'll be at the monastery. And then you can tune into the airwaves. We'll have some mind waves. I'll inform the frequency. Well, you can also then tune your mental waves to that frequency, and we can all have this Dhamma discussion. But that doesn't work because we are humans. There are beings who can do that, but we are humans. Because we have done this disservice to ourselves, having born human, right? The lowest level of the Sugati plane, in fact, it's nothing to be impressed by. or to be proud of that we are humans. It's good that we are one step short of going into the four great hells. That's good, but it's nothing to be impressed by. Because this is just one step short of the four great hells. You have the Brahmas, you have the Devas, you have the humans. That is the last step. And then from then below, yes, the four great hells, no escape. So nothing to be impressed by. See, do you think this is something to be impressed by? I have a sore throat and yet I have to speak. Something to be impressed by? Just think about the plight that we've got ourselves into. How many meals do you have to take? And what good does that do to you? Has that made you happier? Has that made your life content? You know, there's a rent we have to pay for this damn thing. And if you don't pay it for 3 days straight, they kick us out. You can't negotiate after that. You can't ask for better terms. Year on year, you can't ask for a discount. You can't. And unlike a rented house where if something breaks, you know, if the tap starts leaking, right, or a tile breaks, or there's a leak in the roof, you ask the landlord to come and fix it, right? Yes? But what happens when your knee breaks? When your hip breaks? When your tooth goes bad? Who's the landlord? You have to pay rent as well as fix it when it breaks. Become mindfully aware about these bodies that you carry around with you. If you are so utterly impressed by the way you look, your body, and then you think to yourself, look at me, you know, I've got my arms, I've got my legs, right? I'm a full, well-built man or woman, right? Because people spend a lot of time admiring themselves, admiring their bodies. There are magazines dedicated for that sort of thing. There are websites dedicated for that sort of thing. There are television channels dedicated for that sort of thing. To glamorize the human body. Young girls from a very formative years, right? They're fed all sorts of stuff about how to tweak bits about their bodies. How the way their bodies are, when the way the bodies they're born with is not perfect, is not good enough. So they're given this, you know, they're given an idol. This is what you should aim for. And they kept on fed this stuff. At school they pick up these things. In the magazines they pick up these things. On social media they pick up these things. Because these are the videos that go viral. You know, some woman, she'll come on Facebook or on whatever social media and say, you know, previously I used to have a small chest, but now I've got a big one. Look at me. Aren't I very attractive? And you have your 12-year-old watching this at home on Facebook. Nothing wrong with Facebook. Just like there's nothing wrong with a knife. It is your intention that is right or wrong, not the tool, not the device. TV is not bad. What you show on TV can be bad. But your 12-year-old daughter at home, she watches this. Because they're looking for a role model. Young children, they're always looking for a role model. They're like sponges. Whatever environment you put them in, they soak it up. So they're watching this and they're thinking to themselves, they're looking on the screen, right? This is before, this is after. That's how they portray that, right? Before and after. So then they look at the screen and then they look in the mirror and they realize they are inadequate. Something's not, you know, they're insufficient. It's not right. They were not born blessed. So they have to do something about it. This is association. The person doesn't have to be right, sat right next to you. You know, nowadays, because we have social media, we have technology, we have phones in our hands, right? That association comes to you 24/7. Those days, it used to be like that. You know, parents had far more control over who their children spend their time with. But now, not so. Because now, every man and his dog has something to say. And because it's open media and it's social media, whatever they say can become viral. And whatever is viral, you know, ends on your feed. And you wonder why it is so difficult to bring your children up. Why it is so difficult to get your children to do what you want them to do. It's because you're only one voice. Your voice is just one voice. And besides, the things that you say are not the things that they want to hear. What do you say most of the time? Don't do this, don't do that. Yeah? And the things you ask them to do are the things they don't want to do. Do your homework. Who wants to do homework? Do your studies. Who wants to do studies? Name one human being who was born into this world to do their studies. There was one man I know who was born into this world, he wanted to become God's son. He wanted to be God's messenger. There was another man that I know who came into this world and who said, Aggo hamasmi lokasa, jetto hamasmi lokasa, setto hamasmi lokasa. I know a man who did that. Show me one man who came into this world and said, I am here to do my homework. Nobody wants to do homework. Did you want to do homework when you were younger? Remember those days when the teacher said, right children, this weekend you are free because we don't have any homework. What did you say? Yay! So you keep telling your children to do things they don't want to do. But what does social media keep telling them? Things they like to do. So whose voice do you think is going to have more of an impact? That voice. Your voice is just one voice, ladies and gentlemen. Please understand this. In the same way that my voice is just one voice. But if you don't hear that voice as well, which you hear on a Sunday morning, then all the other voices that you have are only voices that keep pulling you into a worldly existence. They just keep sucking you down this rabbit's hole. From one vexation to the next vexation, from that to the next vexation, from that to the next vexation, vexation after vexation, right? All you do is keep going, seeking this pleasure, like the donkey behind the carrot, always one step behind. Forever hopeful, but hopelessly hopeful. When did you ever achieve the happiness that you were promised? I ask you. You were promised happiness, weren't you? When did you ever achieve it? They promised you, your tongue will please you. Did it? If it did, why do you still seek happiness? They promised you, your eyes will please you. So go, sit yourself down in front of a big screen. And if it's not big enough, get a bigger one. And if it's not curved enough, get a curved one. And if it's only two-dimensional, get a 3D one. See, technology is very advanced. The promise that you will one day be pleased, that is all you've been living with, a promise, an unfulfilled promise. Wake up. They've taken you for a fool. And I'm beginning to wonder whether they were right. You are the product of your environment. The car you drive today is influenced by the messaging that happens around you. Subliminal messaging, you know this stuff. Word of mouth is the best form of advertisement, is it not? You know this stuff. I'm sure there'll be marketing gurus among yourselves. People who've invested most of their life studying marketing and the human psyche and how do you speak to a mind so that they're convinced. You know, what do people buy? Do they buy things or do they buy people? You tell me. People buy? People buy people. That's why the salesman who comes knocking on your door is dressed so smart. That's why he's clean shaven. That's why he wears Prada. Because he's got to make a good impression. Nothing to do with the product he's going to sell you. Perhaps what he has to sell you, his merchandise, is utter trash. But you're impressed by the image, the impression that he makes on you. So you buy him. You buy him, therefore you buy his product. Ask yourself if this is not the case. Because here's how it works. This is the psychology of putting rubbish and indoctrinations into your mind. If, when a message is delivered to you, your mind is happy, you will absorb it. That's how marketing works. That's why when they want to sell you a bike, first they have to show you a half-naked woman. That's why. Because first they have to please you. Then you will buy any old rubbish. That's the way it works. Look at any advertising campaign. You know, next week, I hope you're doing your homework, right? Here's what your homework for next week. Next time you sit down in front of the TV and watch these TV commercials, have a think about how they're trying to indoctrinate you. Just think of the analytics behind it. Think about the dynamics of it. Think about what they're actually doing, what they must have thought when they designed that advertising program. What was going through their mind when they designed it. Right? Now they want to sell you a toothpaste. Have you seen any advertising campaign where any of the people in there have a sad face? They all have a smiley face, right? Because a smile begets a smile. So the best way to get you to be happy is smile. Hello? See, you're smiling. Because when someone comes in front of you and smiles, right, even if it's a stranger, because they're all strangers on TV, you don't know any of them, right? They're actors. But when they smile, it makes you smile. And when you smile, biologically, when you smile, all these feel-good hormones, they all start taking over. And one leads to the other. Nama leads to the Rupa and Rupa leads to the Nama. So, I can get you to smile in two ways. One, I first say something you like to hear and then you smile. Or I smile and then you smile and then you feel good. It can happen both ways. So either the smile comes first and the joy comes next. Or joy comes first and smile comes next. Either way, you're joyful. And once you're joyful, now I've got the best breeding ground. This is fertile ground for me to plant my message. That is, this is the best toothpaste. You should buy it. Next time you sit in front of your TV, right, and you're watching a program, and nowadays they have more commercials than the actual program, right? It used to be the other way around, but now in between the commercials, they show you a bit of the program. It didn't used to be like that back then. Because, you know, people have to make their money. If something is free, what is being sold? Why is Facebook free? What's the product? Sorry, I asked the wrong question. Who is the product? You are being sold. So if TV channels are free, what's being sold? Why do you think they go through all that effort? You know, the people who act in it, they get paid a lot of money. You know, apparently acting is a good, you can make a fine fortune doing that. Apparently, I've never done it, so I don't know, but people say so. If I'm wrong, my apologies. It's a glamorous industry and people are quite happy to get involved with that. Right? So, but you know, it's big business and it's very expensive. Like the airwaves, it's expensive. The infrastructure, very expensive. Hiring the right kind of people for it, very expensive. To hire the airwaves, very expensive stuff. Right? But they show you the channel for free. Something doesn't add up. A TV program, 2 hours long, costs a fortune to put together, but they show it to you for free. Something doesn't add up, right? How does that work? Of course, you know this stuff. There's the commercials. Do they charge you to show the commercials? No? Sure? Who pays for the commercials? Oh, okay, I'll prove it to you. A box of chocolates. Okay. 500 rupees. Manufacturing costs. Let's break it down. Actually, in fact, the actual amount of chocolate, right? And whatever the ingredients are in this. Okay, the cost of the ingredients. It won't be that much. I mean, this is just, it won't be that much. In fact, usually when they mark up a product, it's about 5 times the cost of the actual product, right? So let's just say 100 for that. Then there's packaging, 25. Then there's distribution, because they have to get the product from the factory to your doorstep. Let's put another 25. Right, so we have a running total, we have 150. Then they have to pay wages. Yes, because there are the people who work in the factories, there are the salesmen, right, there are the office workers, the people who pick up the phone, the customer center, operations line. Right, all those things have to be paid. Right? Add another 25. 175. But you're not going to buy this if you don't know about this. Would you? Of course you're not going to buy this if you don't know about this. If you didn't know about this, you wouldn't buy it. So then you have to be informed about this. And to do that, they have to advertise it. So that will come in the shape of posters, banners, TV commercials, newspaper advertisements, radio adverts, and all sorts. $275. That's another 100, $275. But they're not in the business of charity, they're here to make money. So they mark it up to 500. The rest is profit, right? For the shareholders, they have to make their money. Now, this 100 was the 100 that they had to spend so that you got to know about the chocolate. And they designed the advert so that once you watch it, you want it. Because they'll design the advert in such a way that it'll make you feel that if you don't have this chocolate, you're going to die. This is what you need for your health. This is what's going to bring you good luck for the next 25 years of your life. Your wife will stay with you until you die if you eat this chocolate. She will never be unfaithful. You know all the kind of rubbish they put on commercials. You know this stuff. Have you not watched the adverts where they say, you know, like mother's love? I'm not going to, you know, name anything specific because it wouldn't be nice, right? But like mother's love, what? A loaf of bread. A bottle of milk. A tub of butter. Like mother's love. Is that what mother's love is? A tub of butter. I mean, that comes from the cow. So what actually are they implying? Actually, I get what they're implying. Only cows would fall for this stuff. So yes, like mother's love. But that's how they brand it. Once again, I've got nothing against the people who do the advertising campaigns. In fact, I have a lot of respect for them. Why? Because they are masters in this art. You've got to appreciate good work. Yeah, you've got to appreciate the devil. Right? The devil's good. When what he does really well. You've got to appreciate good work. In the same manner, I respect them. Here's who I don't have respect for. People who fall victim to this. People who buy this stuff willy-nilly. So do come out of this thinking that you are free to make your own choices. You are here right now, ladies and gentlemen, because of the influences that you had. Maybe by chance you heard a sermon from somewhere and that is what brought you here. Maybe someone else invited you to come here. Maybe someone said there's going to be free sandwiches at the end of it, so come along. Just jesting. You're here because of your environment. This is why it's so important to make sure that you are in the right environment. I don't think people think about this enough times and check whether they're in the right environment. I don't think people do it enough. If they did, they wouldn't spend so much time on Facebook doing useless stuff. Again, once again, I emphasize this point. Facebook itself is not bad. I mean, we put our Dhamma sermons on Facebook as well from time to time. So Facebook itself is not bad. But be honest to yourself. Don't answer this question to me. It's a rhetorical question. You can answer it for yourself. The last time you went on Facebook, okay, was it for something productive or unproductive? Don't answer. If you added up all the time you spent on Facebook so far, like not till the big dawn of time, just say, you know, the last month, right, we are towards the end of October, just think of the last month. Now these days you have devices that can tell you how much time you spent on these apps, right? Just go onto your phone somewhere, it'll tell you how long you spent on that app, right? And then ask yourself the question, how much did you actually get out of putting that time in there? If that was a bank, you wouldn't put your money in it, I tell you. You wouldn't. Won't you agree? But you think 100 times before you put your money into a bank account. You go around town checking all the interest rates. You ask around, you check in the newspapers, you check on TV, you ask around, you go on the websites, investment advice, you get all that before you put your money into a bank account. But this is money you can earn if you lose it. But your valuable human life, the time that you have to free yourself from suffering, I think, you know, what I'm really trying to ask, I'm asking you to do, folks, is to redefine what being human is about. Please. What is your definition of being human? Most people's definition of being human is doing things that humans do. And what do humans do? They eat. They sleep. They drink. They reproduce, they learn, they play, they make money, they travel, they get into relationships. This is what people do. A few things more than what animals do. Animals also eat, they sleep, they drink, and they reproduce. But they don't do much more than that. What is being human? That and a few more things. Like learning, educating ourselves, building houses, buying cars, traveling the world. These things animals don't do. When animals, they build a house, but they only build a house that is big enough. Have you seen a lion build a 3-story den? No, right? Or a monkey? Build a house with a swimming pool? They don't do that stuff. They only do what is enough for them. They only do what is enough for their physical sustenance. But we as human beings, we think that human life can be used for much more than that. So we try and be better than animals in those ways, but in very primitive ways, I tell you. I want you to redefine what being human is, at least now. It's not too late if you're here. At least now, begin to redefine what being human is. Here's what being human is about. I'll tell you and you see whether you agree with me. This is your chance to free yourself from suffering once and for all. Ask yourself whether you agree with me or not. Let me say that again. Being human is your chance to free yourself from suffering once and for all. If you ask me, that is what being human is about. Now ask yourself, is that what most people do, having been born human? Do they free themselves from suffering once and for all, or is all they do go through life, vexation after vexation after vexation, and just seeking relief from those vexations and enjoying the pleasure as they do, as they go along? Is that what being human is about? Don't you want your human life to amount to something at the end of it? Do you know the difference between distance and displacement? Distance is how far you have traveled. Displacement is how far you are at the end of that journey from where you started. Yes? Would it not be a very sorry tale if at the end of your lives you will have to say, I have traveled a lot. I have traveled very far. I traveled many leagues. But hey, I'm back where I started. Most people's lives, at the end of that life, what is their displacement? Zero. They are born crying and they die crying. Displacement? Zero. Meaning, that's just fuel that has been wasted. What is the fuel there then? Human life. Wasted human life. You know this, ladies and gentlemen, I'm trying to inspire you to do something more with your lives. That's what I'm trying to do here. Allow me to speak to your heart. You need to open up so that I can speak to you. When you're here, I want you to be one with me. I want you to connect with me. Once you leave this room, that's fine. I'm not going to say a word to you. Because I won't have a chance to say a word to you, because there'll be so many others who will come and surround you and they'll be telling you what they have to tell you. I can't fight them. I can't compete with them. I am outnumbered, one to about a million. All the people who surround you. And it's not because they are vile, it's only because they don't know the answer themselves. It's the blind leading the blind. That's what it is a case of. Blind leading the blind. Take a moment to think about how much property you have. Just for a moment, right? Just, you know, remind yourself how much property you have. Whatever that might be. Like collectively, we probably got enough property to buy half the land, half of Sri Lanka. Right? Just take a moment to think about how much property you have. Now tell me, you spent how much of your life acquiring that? Building that up from nothing? Raising it up from the ground, brick by brick? Just think about this. Some may have not just property here, but maybe in other parts of the world as well. Maybe you have a tower to your name on the moon. Soon enough that will happen. When this is not enough. How many houses do you have? One, two, three. How many acres of land do you have? One, two, three. I mean hundreds. There's the coconut estate, there's the tea estate, there's the rubber estate. Maybe some of you have your own private island somewhere. All that you built from nothing, right? But did you actually put nothing to build it? You put in something. Just the dollars? Just the rupees and cents? That, if you lose, you can regain. But you put in something that you can never get back. The chance to achieve the ultimate bliss. The chance to free yourself once and for all from suffering is what you are investing. I'm trying to show you that you're making a very uninformed investment, which is only going to make you a loss at the end. I don't think you want to go into this investment because you're walking into it blindly. Like you're walking into investments in your life blindly. You don't know what you're doing. See what you invested in building up that business? Yes, you know, you have to live, of course. We have to make some money. But we have to make some money. We have to have some wealth, some property so that we can survive. But is that what you put in most of your life into? Did you only invest your lives into building up that something that was sufficient? Or did you put into making surplus? Yes, of course you can say, I've got so much to my name. Here are all the deeds. Here's all my property. Look at my bank account. Look at the number of zeros I have at the end of that. I used to do the same, so I know what a fool I was. Almost 25 years of my good life wasted. My youthful life wasted. You know, if you ignore the first, say, this is the first 7, 10 years, which, you know, we are very young, can't understand the thing that's going on around us, just ignore that, right? But then from 10, say 15, on to about 25, a good 10 years of my life. Education? Yes, but I educated myself to more than what I needed. Property? More than I needed. Cars? More than I needed. Wealth? Much more than I needed. In 60 years of having lived my life, well, you know, give or take, let's say in 30 years from now, when I'll be ill, when I'll be too weak, when I'll be too weak to be doing anything, let's just say I have another 40 years left in me, let's just say, right? In 40 years' time, I'll be good to no one. When that day comes, I can look back at all my educations, my paper qualifications, all the property I have built, all the money I have in my bank account, and then what claim do I have to them? Just one, to say, see all the things I built up. I can say that, and that's all I have. Just being able to say that, because none of it will really actually belong to me in 2 minutes when I'm gone. But to earn that, to earn the right to say that, I invested real human life. Because when you're gone, someone else will put their name against your bank account. Yes or no? All the property you have, someone else will come along, they'll just erase your name and put their name. The solicitors will work through that without a problem. Well, you have to pay them in advance as well for that. They'll take part of the estate as solicitor fees so that they can erase your name and put someone else's name. You know, for a temporary feeling of entitlement, look what you have sacrificed. You're not sacrificing something temporary, you are sacrificing something permanent. For a temporary claim, to have something to your name. Once again, I'm not saying you have to let go of any of it. I'm always against this letting go idea. You know this. I always tell you, it's not about letting go. Buddhism is not about letting go. It's about realizing. Realization and letting go are very different things. I'm not asking you to let go of anything. I'm asking you to realize what you're doing to yourselves. And ask you the question then, are you happy with what you're doing to yourselves? Are you happy about the way your life is going? You know, week after week, how many sermons have we done by now? 20? About that? So see, 20 weeks I've been coming here talking to you. That time has passed, hasn't it? You didn't even realize it. 20 odd weeks have passed since we started talking. How much have you realized? I ask you. I'm not asking you how much you've let go. I'm asking you how much have you realized? Here's how you can make that assessment. What are you now investing your human life in? I'm here to help you realize the value of human life. That is all I'm trying to do, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here to help you realize the value of human life. They don't teach you that for science. They don't. They'll teach you how to prolong human life. Yes. They may teach you how to live it carefree. Yes, but they don't teach you the value of human life. They don't teach you that. Because they don't understand it themselves. That's because their definition of human life is a very different definition to the one that I hold today. Most people invest human life to earn for themselves something that they can claim to be theirs until their life is done. That's it. How much property did your father have? For those of you who lost their fathers by now, how much property did your father have? Note, I use the past tense, not the present. I didn't ask you how much does your father have, because he's gone now. All that property then became whose? Yours. And after you, maybe your children's. And after them, their children's. And so on. So the property always remained. But the people who owned the property, they came and went. So what did they actually make out of their lives? You know, what real people are really doing is just looking after someone else's property until they come and claim it. You're just looking after your children's property until they come and claim it from you. No? Do you disagree? Fathers in the room? Mothers in the room? Here's what you're doing with your property. It's not your property, it's your children's property. You're just looking after it for them until they're old enough to take it off you. And what are they going to do? They will look after it until their children are ready for it. So, that being the case, which one is of greater value here? Is it you with the human life or is it the property? It seems like the property is more valuable than your life. Because what you're doing is taking care of property so that it can be passed on from generation to generation to generation. The focus is on the property to ensure it's safe. In exchange, you sacrifice human life. The only question I have is this. Are you doing this mindfully? Do you know you are doing this to yourselves? Do you know this is happening to you? Perhaps you may not until someone shows it to you from this angle. This is a different perspective on life. It's just a different perspective. See, you're looking after someone else's property until they come along and take it off your shoulder, off your hands. That's it. Actually, you're looking after someone else's wife. literally as well. If you have a daughter, you're looking after someone else's wife until they're ready to come and take her off your hands. But when your wife is dead, if she's born again somewhere, now she's somebody else's wife anyway, right? Yeah, when she's dead and she's born somewhere else, now she's someone else's wife anyway. So, for the time being, you're looking after someone else's wife. And in her previous birth, she was another man's wife. So now you're with another man's wife. Come on, have some dignity. Am I bursting all your bubbles? You know, I wouldn't speak like this if the life, this imaginary life that you're living was a real one. Right? This dream world that you're living in, if that were real, I wouldn't bother waking you up. Trust me. If the matrix were real, I wouldn't unplug you from it. I wouldn't bother. I wouldn't try to. But the matrix is not real. It's a make-believe world. And they're feasting off you. I can't watch that happen to you. They're feasting off you. So come out of this thinking that you are the Lord. Come out of this thinking that you determine, you decide all the things that you're going to do with your life. That is not the case. You're being influenced heavily by your environment. In fact, right now I'm influencing you as well. I'm manipulating you. I'll be upfront about that. But I have a guilt-free conscience. I can manipulate you all I like and sleep easy at night. Because I know why I did it and why I'm doing it. It is not to get anything out of you. Anything at all. It is to give you what I have. I'm trying to convince you to take what I have because I enjoy what I have today. I'm in a state of bliss that you are still to experience. I invite you to try it out. All I'm asking you is to take a different perspective, ladies and gentlemen. Not to let go. I keep saying this time and time again, lest you think that I'm trying to ask you to let go of all the things you have and go and live the life of a hermit. Not so. Don't ever let go of anything you're not prepared to. Do the preparation first. When I left my lay life behind, I had no regrets. Zero. To this day, there's not been a single day in my life where I wished, ever since I became a monk, not a single day where I wished, oh, I wish I had my TV. Oh, I wish I had my phone. Oh, I wish I had my laptop. Oh, I wish I had my wife. Oh, I wish I had my car. Oh, I wish I could go traveling. I'll let you in on a secret. The other day, we went for a sermon at Sri Lankan Airlines. They invited us to do a sermon for a group of their senior executives. And so we went there, did a sermon. So while I was in the waiting room, some of the staff, they came over and said, Swaminathan sir, please don't be offended by this. And I honestly wasn't, not one bit, because I realized that they were making the best offering that they could. No, they didn't give me a jet. But they gave me the closest thing to one. At least they offered it. They said, Swaminathan sir, we are in the center where pilots train. So this is the simulation center. If Swaminathan sir wishes, we can give you a tour of the simulation room. They have the Boeing jets, and it's the whole simulation place. You can go there and experience the simulation. And this is where pilots come to train. So, out of great respect, because that is the best they could offer, right? If anyone comes there, that would typically be what people would like to go and see, right? Because it's not the kind of thing you can go and see anywhere and everywhere. You need to get a VIP pass to get through there. So I spoke to the person who came and spoke and made the invitation. I said, "Sir, I've already got my pilot's license. So I don't need to go into another simulation center. But if you have a few more people, bring them along. And while we wait for the next program, let's come and have a chat. Maybe I can give you a pilot's license. Perhaps I can give you wings to fly." Folks, when I have realized that there is no sight that is worth seeing, do you think you're going to find me in a simulation center? Do you think you'll ever find me in Singapore going sightseeing? There's only one sight worth seeing in Singapore. People who are yet to understand the Dhamma. That is a sight worth seeing. That sight I'm prepared to see when the day comes, if the day comes. But there's no other sight worth seeing. I don't come to Rajagiriya for any other reason than to see this sight. Minds hoping for freedom, hoping to be free. Minds, human lives, waiting to be saved. I can't save you, but I can give you the path to freedom. I can show you the path. You have to walk it, ladies and gentlemen. You have to walk it. So that was a very fine occurrence there. And I said, please bring a few people. Let's have a discussion. So a few of them came. We sat down and we spoke for about a couple of hours. And I, honest to God, like, there wasn't a single chitta that arose within me. Not a single chitta arose within me to think, oh, I wonder what it's like in there. But I remember when I was younger, flying, I spent quite a lot of my time in the air, flying from, especially from London to Edinburgh, where I used to work. I often wondered, what must the cockpit be like? Perhaps I could go and get a taste of that. I often wondered. And here's an opportunity. Some might give a king's ransom for that. But it didn't interest me, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not boasting about myself. I'm boasting about the Dhamma. I'm boasting about the Sasana. That's what I'm boasting here. Not me. See what the Dhamma has done to me? A man who couldn't be in one place for 3 days straight. A man who used to look forward to a weekend, a long weekend, so that he could go around traveling, watching things, looking at things, enjoying good food, dining, adventure. I loved adventure. Rock climbing, canoeing, all sorts, cycling. Those are the things that I used to do for kicks. Those are the things that thrilled me. But not anymore. Those things don't excite me anymore. They don't make me happy anymore. I don't see any pleasure in them anymore. And no, I haven't let go. I've just realized. That's why I say, to this day, there's not been a single day, not one. It's been almost 6 years since I ordained. Not one single day where I thought to myself, oh, did I come too soon? Another day, another trip, another country, if I'd gone there? Never. If it is a lie that I speak, may I be struck by lightning. Not a single day. From the day I came into robes, I have loved this. The bliss that it has entailed me. the joy that it has offered me, the noble association, the noble companionship that I'm surrounded by, and the truth day in, day out, is always the truth that resonates in my ears. And each time I hear that truth, I realize a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. And with each realization, I come to realize happiness is always with me. I don't have to go looking for it. I cook my own rice. I cook my own food. I cook my own happiness. So then why do you go looking for it outside? And you keep on looking for it. Ever hopeful, one day I will get it. One day I'll find that movie, when I watch it, I will be thrilled. You think to yourself, how many times have you done that already? When is that day going to come, I ask you? You'll all die with unfinished business. That's what's going to happen. Unless you do what the Buddha says, you'll all die with unfinished business. And what happens with unfinished business, you will come back to finish it. That's what happens. That's why when you are dead, you are born again. Unfinished business. Unfinished how? Because the business you are in is trying to be happy. That is the business. Trying to be happy. Trying to be joyful. Trying to be merry. But that carrot is always one step ahead. Because it's tied to you. So one step you keep forward, the carrot always moves one step forward. You know the drill. But ever hopeful, but hopelessly hopeful. So come to your senses, ladies and gentlemen. Please open your eyes and just understand what's happening to you. You know, just on the way here this morning, I was thinking to myself, I must go to Rajagiri. I was thinking to myself, for as long as my legs can carry me, for long as someone can drive me here, I'll bring myself here, because, you know, I think about you and I think, geez, you know, how many weeks have these people been coming along here? And I still haven't been able to convince them enough. I was critiquing myself. Twenty odd weeks, more or less, we've been talking about this. It's good. I honor you and I appreciate you. And I hats off that you keep coming here. But what I want for you to happen within you is for you to realize this truth. You know, we are not going to meet every day like this. You know that, right? There's going to be a last sermon, you know that, right? This is not like Kopika Day. There will be a last sermon. That will be the last sermon, either because of you or because of me. I need something to happen within you before that day comes. I want the light of wisdom to shine bright in your mind. I want you to realize the truth. I want you to realize whenever you experience pleasure, this is just a fallacy. This is madness. This is lunacy. Pleasure did not come from the cake, piece of cake that I just ate. It didn't. I want you to realize that. You may still experience pleasure, but all the while you'll know that this pleasure did not come from the cake. That's the point I want to get you to first. And I hope you are not very far from there. I hope. I really hope. For your sake. Because for as long as you think it's in the cake that you get your pleasure, you'll keep on thinking that. And today's cake is not going to do it for you. So tomorrow they'll have to make another cake. Today it's going to be a strawberry cake. Tomorrow they'll have to try chocolate cake. Because you still keep on thinking, cake is going to make me happy. So just keep on eating cake. Piece after piece after piece, you'll try cake. But cake is never going to do it for you. But you'll always be hopeful. No, cake will do it for me. So you keep on trying different types of cake. And then they'll say, somewhere in Japan, they've made this new cake. It's the most delectable. The most delicious type of cake. So what you'll do then is, you get yourself on a jet and you fly yourself to Japan so you can try that. And once you're there, you'll have a bite of it. Temporarily, you will feel, yes, found it. Temporarily. But that temporary pleasure, if you don't come to your senses in that moment, you will think came from the cake. When in fact, it was simply your relief from vexation. The vexation that had been building up in your mind all the while as you were preparing yourself for it, packing your bags, getting yourself on a jet, flying all the way to Japan, getting yourself off at the airport, getting yourself to the restaurant and trying it out. All the while, vexation building up inside, almost bursting at the seams. And at the moment you get to experience that, you think that pleasure came from cake. So here's what else you will do. You will become an ignoble friend. How so? You'll go around telling people. You'll go around telling others, there's this wonderful cake. It's the best there is, you've got to try it. In the same way that you were indoctrinated, you will indoctrinate somebody else. This is why the Mara has enlisted all of you to do his dirty job. Mara Minisu. When are you going to leave Mara's clan and join the Buddhas? Because every time, folks, you know, seriously, every time you speak to someone, especially if your voice is a very influential one, every time you speak to someone and say, there's a nice film, you've got to watch it. Machan, there's his latest new album. Beautiful. It's like pouring honey into my ears. You should watch it. You should listen to it. Every time you say that, this is a musavad. This is false speech. People think false speech is simply, you know, giving a white lie. When are you coming? Today or tomorrow? I'm coming tomorrow. When actually you're coming today? People think that is lying. That's not lying. I mean, what harm does that do? At most, it might be a temporary loss for them. Right? They miss the opportunity because they were expecting you tomorrow, you've come today, and they missed the boat. So what? They'll still die. Won't they? If they miss their appointment with you, are they not going to die? No, they'll still die. Are they going to become immortal? Oh no, they're still going to die. But, here's what. Here's how you can make someone immortal. Tell someone that a piece of cake is delicious. You give them that hope. If they are indoctrinated by your words, this is the musavada, the worst kind of musavada. Right? You give them that, you drop that word on them. That seed is planted in their minds because their minds are fertile ground for false speech. Because the mind is ridden with ignorance and attachment. So the moment you give them hope that happiness can be found in that piece of cake, now they'll go looking for it. And then they'll try the cake. And when they try the cake, they will be relieved from vexation. And then they will experience a moment of pleasure. And then they will think that pleasure came from the cake. And then they'll keep trying to eat the cake. Keep eating more and more and more. But soon enough they'll realize, I keep eating more, but I'm not being happy. But then he said that the pleasure was in the cake. So maybe it's not in this cake. Perhaps it's in another cake. So I'll try the other one. See what you've done to them? There are two types of friends in this world. Noble friends and ignoble friends. I call them Kalyanamitras and Kalyavanamitras. These are the two kinds of friends. One is a Kalyanamitra, who shares the truth. Pleasure is not in a piece of cake, so don't bother. Don't bother. Don't bother going after it. Don't bother getting on a jet. Don't bother doing more than you need to do for your sustenance. You know, when we have food, ladies and gentlemen, as Swami Nohan says, or you know, on days you observe precepts like the seal, you may do this as well at the temple. We do the pratyeksha. Patisankha yoniso, pindapatam patisevam. Neva davaya, namadaya, namandanaya, and so on. This is the perfect mantra. See, this was devised by the Buddha. In this stanza is contained the purpose of eating. So beautiful. If you want to know why people have to eat, check out that stanza. That's why people have to eat. Not why people want to eat, but why people have to eat. Neva davaya, namadaya. It is not for the purpose of glorifying my body. It's not for the purpose of pleasuring myself. Then what is it for? Yavadeva imasa kaya satitya. This body is a collection of things. That's what, like, any body is a collection of things, right? We say a body of water. What is a body of water? A collection of water. That's why this is called a body, because it's a collection. That is what a body is, a collection. The human body is a collection of things that enables these things to work in unison with each other to do the things that a human is supposed to do. That is why this is called the body. The body is a collection, or a kaya. But when we think of the word body, we think the whole thing as one unit. It's not. It's not a single unit. The body, the word itself means it's a collection. Yavadeva imasa kaya satithiya. For the sustenance of this body. Sustenance. Not pleasuring it. Sustenance. Iti puranancha vedanam patihankam. Any pain that the body had to endure because of lack of nourishment, lack of energy, lack of nutrients to fulfill that. Previous bodily pains, so that they don't come back to you. So there may be some foods that you have to eat to keep off certain physical ailments. Maybe, you know, we take energy because we need energy. We need the calories that we need to you know, use our bodies as we need to. Navancha vedanang na uppadesami. So that new physical pains, which would come if we don't take a meal, don't come. So we can ward off such pains. This is talking about physical pain, physical discomfort. Because we are not in the business of torturing ourselves. Self-torture has nothing to do with Buddhism. That's what the Buddha realized. You know, even before he became the Buddha, he realized, you know, this is nonsensical. This is self-torture. You know, at one point, he reduced himself to eating just a grain of sand, a grain of rice every day. And then even that he gave up and ultimately said, whatever falls into my alms bowl from the sky, I will take it. He pushed it that far. You've seen the Bodhisattva statues at the time where he was an ascetic. Where you could touch his stomach and you would feel his spine, and touch his spine and you would feel his, you could touch his stomach. Right? He was so thin. That was self-torture. And then he realized self-torture is not what you need to do. Because really what he was trying to do was, again, this was bad associations. Ultimately. Even the Bodhisattva had bad associations. Because the people who were with him told him that the way to cleanse yourself of your defilements is to punish yourself for the bad deeds you've done. And keep on punishing yourself until you have fully paid up. Until you have fully, what's the word? There's a word in the Christian faith for this. I think it's repentance. Yeah. Until you've fully paid for all the sins you've done. And then he realized this is not what you need to do. See, had he stayed there like that for another day, you know, that would have been the end of his story. Now he had experienced both. Living an indulgent lifestyle as well as living the other extreme. And then people think, so therefore he gave us a medium. Not a medium, rather, the middle path. Therefore not indulgence, but not self-torture, somewhere in the middle. That is not what the middle path is. Because the middle path has nothing to do with the body. It's wrong to say it's the middle path, to be honest. It's not the middle of anything. It is a medium. That's cool when we learn, yeah? We will educate ourselves at school. You know, they have a medium of instruction, right? So you learn either in English, in Sinhalese, in Tamil, right? There's a medium of instruction. In the same manner, there's a medium of liberation. So it's not the middle path. Majjhima Patipada cannot be translated to middle path, although that's what you'll see in most textbooks. So what do we do? Let's go protest, shall we? No. That's not our task. People do what they can as best they can, and if that is not the truth, then it's, you know, that's everyone down to themselves, right? Every man for himself. It's not the middle path that the Buddha taught. What the Buddha taught was the medium to liberation. Majjhima is madhya. Madhya is medium. The medium to liberation. Now you understand the word medium. So like sound needs a medium to travel. Yeah? In the same way, to travel to Nibbana, you need a medium. And that medium is the Noble Eightfold Path. It's a path. That is the medium to liberation. It's not the middle of anything. It's not the middle between two extremes. That's not what it is. But most people think, not too indulgent, not the other extent, middle. Because of this loose translation. But I need you to understand that what the Buddha speaks of, that's why I say, you know, oftentimes I tell you in the sermons, if you have a luxury lifestyle, you don't have to let go of that. And then you might wonder, but then Swami knows the Buddha speaks of the middle path. So how can I live a life like this if I'm not following the middle path? I have so much for myself. I have these cars, I have these houses, I have this property, I have so much wealth to my name. You know, how can I live the middle path with all this money, with all this wealth? Then you have a problem. But I tell you, Buddha's middle path is not a middle path, it's a medium. It's a medium to liberation, nothing to do with being in the middle of anything. And on the other hand, say you've got nothing to yourself. You've got nothing, no wealth, no property, you know, you just about make ends meet. And almost on the verge of asceticism or austerity. Then you might come and ask me, Swami, how am I going to attain Nibbana like this? I live a very austere life. I have hardly anything to my name. Like, think about Sunita and Sopaka. Do you think they took the middle path? What middle path did they have? You know, they were considered scum of the earth back then. The lowest caste there was. Hardly anything at all. But the Buddha saw them. He preached to them. I mean, if you need the middle path to Nibbana, how much time should you be in the middle? Tell me. How long must you be in the middle until the Nibbana happens for you? So you don't live an indulgent life for 10 years, a life of austerity for another 10 years, then the middle path for how many years must you live that? Not too much, not too less. How many years? And how long did it take Dharuchira to understand the Dhamma and become an Arahant? Just a few words. How long did he live the middle path? Dharuchira was a non-believer back then, right? So he had his own faith. And he was called Dharuchira because, yeah, I remember I explained to you what Chivara was last time, right? He wore twigs and branches of trees and that sort of thing. That was his clothing. He was clad in that. That's why Dharuchira. Dharu is Dara, wood. Bits of wood. That's what he had in his, around his body. So he came to the Buddha, he'd heard about the Buddha from someone, and someone said, you know, the Buddha is here, he's here to preach the Dhamma, then I must go see him. And so he left, looking for the Buddha, on foot, non-stop, until he met the Buddha. And he said, Venerable Sir, please preach the Dhamma to me. I have come looking for you. You are the purpose of my existence. I need you. I need to hear what you have to say. And then the Buddha said, Dharuchiri, I'm going on alms right now. I'll come back to you later. After I finish my alms round, I'll come and talk to you. And Dharuchiri said, Venerable Sir, but I don't really trust my life. What faith can I have? How can I trust my life? So then the Buddha gave him a sermon, a very short sermon, the shortest sermon ever given. Rarajirya, ditte ditta mattam, sute suta mattam, mute muta mattam, vinyate vinyata mattam. Got it, Dharuchiri? Sir, I got it. Dharuchiri becomes an arahant. Tell me, how long did he live the middle path? If for Nibbana you need to be on the middle path, not too indulgent, not too austere, how long must you be on the middle path? So I prove my point to you then. It's not the middle of anything. It's a medium to Nibbana. In the moment that Dharuchirya heard those words, Samma Ditti, Samma Sankappa, Samma Vacha, Samma Kammanta, Samma Ajiva, Samma Vayama, Samma Sati, Samma Samadhi, Samma Jnana, Samma Vimukti. This is the medium that he traversed mentally in his mind, because his wisdom was so profound. You know, he was like a balloon, almost just ready to be burst. And all the Buddha had to do was just show a prick, not even prick it. Just show a needle. And therefore he went on to become the foremost among those who attained arahathood by listening to a very short discourse. This is the title that the Venerable Dharuchirya Thera has. He is one of the 80 greatest disciples of the Buddha. And he is foremost for having understood the Dhamma in such a short period of time. So if it was done in such a short period of time, and you need the middle path to get to Nibbana, then how long was he in the middle path? That's what I always tell you folks. You know, live the lives you live already. I'm not asking you to change any aspect of it. Live a happy life. Engage in your duties, responsibilities, right? Fulfill them, teach your children, right? Work, live, right? Build your houses, right? Do whatever you have to do. But allow yourself the time to reflect on the truth. This is a purely mental task. Nothing to do with what you're doing with your arms and legs. Your realization must happen within you. This is just insight. Once the penny drops, what I need you to do from there on is to reflect on it. That's why I gave you homework last week and the week before as well. I need you to do this when you're at home. Otherwise, you're only doing it here on a Sunday morning. You know, one half of a day, you reflect on the Dhamma. 6.5 days, you are in Mara's clan. What hope do I have? To become a Buddha Putra or a Buddha Dhyani, you need to contemplate on his Dhamma. Yo Dhammam Passati, so Mam Passati. If you want to see the Buddha, you have to be with his Dhamma. So contemplate on the Dhamma. Whatever little you have understood, contemplate on that. Whatever little. You know, there are those among you who have been coming along for every sermon. I've seen you every week. So by now, I've given you plenty. Yes, there are a few bits more that we need to talk about, but you've already got plenty to start contemplating. You need to be doing that when you're not here. Because when you're here, I control what you think, don't I? You've given me the liberty to do that, for as long as you stay awake, of course, though. See, again, environment. When you're in this environment, you can't let your mind wander away into all sorts, you know, I need to do that, I need to do that, go to the party, organize this, that and the other. You can't do that because I keep bringing you back into reality. I talk to you. I bring your attention back and keep you in the Dhamma, explain the Dhamma to you. But when you're not here, you're with the Maras clan. No one's going to encourage you to contemplate on the Dhamma. They'll come and tell you this, Machan, new movie, shall we? There's a new restaurant in town. They do the finest crabs. Let's go there. How many different types of kottu have you tried by now? Why? Honestly, why? Each one you had, you thought this was the deal, right? Remember when you first tried cheese kottu? When that was a new fad. And you tried it and you first for the first time, you thought, this is the one. That's it. I'm in heaven. What happened when the next one came along? Then what happened to cheese kottu? You can never be satisfied by pleasing your senses. And for the simple reason that your senses can never bring you happiness. Because happiness does not exist outside. So the more you keep expecting it to come from the outside, the more your life will become frustrated. The more you will be disappointed. The more you will become a wreck. And there are some who go mad in the search of pleasures from the outside world. They go insane, they just lose it. In fact, the reason most people go insane is because they were expecting happiness to come from the outside, right? And on one occasion, any hope of it coming to them was lost. Just take a moment to think about, you know, people who end up in mental asylums, how they got there. And then you realize how dangerous it is to expect happiness from the outside. You know the reason you're not mad yet? Is because you still can keep your hopes high. That's why. If you love your children so much that you can't imagine an existence without them, if you get to hear that your daughter was in a car accident and she died, it's possible that you'll go mad on hearing this news. It's quite possible, because there are people, there are many mothers, more than I can care to count, mothers who have gone insane because they got to learn that their children have died. Why does that happen? It's because they expect their happiness to come from their children. A child's smile makes me happy. A child's cry makes me happy. A child playing makes me happy. A child's words makes me happy. Just listening to her voice, her sweet voice makes me happy. Her achievements make me happy. My children's children make me happy. See how much you have hung your happiness on a mirage? You've completely outsourced your happiness. That's what you've done. Completely outsourced your happiness. At what risk? You know, if anyone here is into business, before you outsource something, you have to evaluate the risk, don't you? Just think about it. I mean, any businessman worth his salt will know that when you manufacture something, if you want to outsource something, let's say a toothpaste company, if it is toothpaste that they manufacture and that is their specialty, here are some of the things that they will outsource. The tube, the cap, the printing, the box, the toothpaste, If they outsource that, what are they manufacturing? So they insource, or rather they keep with them what their specialty is, and they outsource the rest. Does that not make good financial sense? Good economic sense? Absolutely. Makes perfect sense. Most things that you see around you are like that. Right? Usually companies, when they manufacture things, they don't manufacture all of it in one factory. They usually outsource stuff and then bring it in and then assemble them. You know this stuff, right? So, if your business is happiness, need I say more? If you have come into this world seeking happiness, are you nuts to outsource happiness to others? Have you gone crazy already? I mean, I get outsourcing other things, but how can you outsource your happiness? Because that is what you have come into this world for. If you outsource your happiness, that will be an unfinished business and you will keep coming back. What do they say? If you want something done right, do it yourself. If you want happiness done right, go on. Do it yourself. I'm here to give you that message. If you want happiness done right, do it yourself. If you expect somebody else to make you happy, trust me, they will do what makes them happy. That's why, despite your whinging and your moaning, your daughter will still run away with the guy that she's in love with. You can tell her, but I am the one who brought you up. I am the one who fed you. I am the one who looked after you. I am the one who wiped the tears off your face and the poo-poo off your bum. I am the one who doted myself on you, and I dedicated my entire life to you. How do you do something like this to me? She is just a mind. When the mind is vexed, all it seeks is a vent for that vexation. She doesn't care much about who else is around her. You know this. When you are vexed, you do things that are completely irrational. That is why later on you begin to wonder, why did I do that? When you come to your senses. You know, the very fact that you have regrets in your life is good damn proof that in that moment you only do what you need to do in that moment. You have no reflection, no contemplation of what the consequences of these actions are. And that is not your fault. It's just the way the mind works. Because in every moment, ladies and gentlemen, there is just a chitta. No two chittas arrive at once. In this chitta, in this moment, there is a chitta. And in this moment, if that chitta is vexed for a piece of cake, by hook or by crook, it will go get it. That is how chittas work. Others, you wonder, you know, why do people steal? Don't they know stealing is bad? Don't they know that if they steal, they're going to get in trouble? Don't they know they're going to go to prisons or get damned? They do. Of course they do. They do. They know this. But in the moment where their mind is vexing for whatever it is that they need, you know, you're out of your senses. That is why sometimes you do things which you later try to rationalize and you wonder, why the heck did I do that? It made no sense to do it. But in that moment, you know, you were so utterly vexed. You know you have an exam coming up tomorrow morning, but you still sit down and watch the match. Never happened. But tomorrow morning you will regret, won't you? The following morning you regret. And then you kick yourself. Why did I do that? Because it was not you at that moment. In other words, it's never you. It's just a chitta. A chitta that has no dhamma is a helpless, hopeless chitta. A helpless, hopeless chitta. A chitta that has no dhamma. A chitta that has the dhamma. What is the dhamma? The dhamma is the truth. A chitta that has the dhamma is not vexed. It does not vex because there is no attachment. It does what a chitta is supposed to do. Rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana. That's it. No tanha, no upadana, no bhava, no jati, no abhisankara. You know the deal. Avidya paccha, sankara paccha, vinyana paccha, namurupa paccha, salayatana paccha, passa paccha, vedana paccha, tanha paccha, upadana paccha, bhava paccha, jati paccha, jara marana shoka parideva dukkha domana sevadasa kevalasa dukkha khandasa samudayo hoti, says the Buddha. The 11 great fires, from top to bottom, the 11 great fires are all because of avidya. That's the root. Ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of the fact that happiness does not exist outside. So the more you keep on thinking that happiness will come to you one day from the outside, your Prince Charming will one day bring you your happiness. That on your next birthday, you will get happiness wrapped up in a gift, in a box. The more you keep on thinking like that, folks, careful, one day you will go mad. One day. The reason you've not gone mad yet is because still you can be hopeful. That's why. If you go into the mental asylum, go to Angoda and speak to a few people, you can't speak to them now, it's too late. But if you find out their stories, right? If you try and find their stories, why have they ended up there? It's because they've lost something. Maybe a sudden accident. They lost a child. Maybe they lost their car. Maybe they lost a job. Maybe they lost their mother. Maybe they lost a windfall that was due to come to them, but they lost it. Maybe they lost their honor. Maybe that's what they lost. Whatever, they've lost something that they were attached to. That's why. And they lost it for good. They had no hope of ever reclaiming that or regaining that. At that point, the mind becomes so utterly desperate. This is how madness happens. The mind gets so utterly desperate because now there's no hope. Imagine you wanted this. You want this pen? You really want this pen because you really love this pen. You really like this pen. It has much value to you. Perhaps even sentimental value. And I extend it to you and you go, you're hopeful now. Oh, Swaminos is going to give it to me. And then I pull it back. Oh, Swaminos is not going to give it to me. But he still has it. He might give it one of these days. See? And then I bring it closer to you again. Today's the day. Today he looks like he's pointing it to me. Maybe I'm just going to get it today. Maybe with a bit of luck, I can get it today. Maybe if I go and beg him, he might give it to me. Perhaps if I can just borrow it from him for a couple of days, he might give it to me. Or maybe, when he's not looking, I can just go, walk up to him and put it in my pocket and walk away. Then I can get it. See, begging, borrowing and stealing. But because I have the pen here, you can be hopeful. One day, someday, I can get my pen. But what happens the day when I take this into my hand and I break it up into pieces? Or I burn it. Let me ask you a question. It's raining heavily these days, right? There's a lot of lightning. Thunder, lightning and so on. You're at home. Your 6-year-old is playing out in the garden. They're running around a mango tree that you have at home. Your children. The sky starts to get a bit gloomy. You ask the children to come in. Children, Buddha, come in, it's going to rain. No, just for a few more minutes. Alright, just be careful though. It's starting to rain. And then out of nowhere, you just hear this lightning bolt. It sends a shiver up your spine. It's just so loud, thunder and a lightning strike. All this while you heard your children playing outside, but now it's just drop dead silence. Quite literally, drop dead silence. You walk outside and under the mango tree, where there were your children playing around, running around, laughing, giggling, playing with each other, now you see dead. They were struck by lightning. As a mother, how are you going to embrace this situation? Too grim? No, because this happened in our country. Once it got reported, other times it doesn't get reported. Once it got reported. If ever you watch that video clip, this happened many years ago, this very incident that I just described to you, it happened in Sri Lanka. If you watch that video clip, and if you remember that incident, do you recall how the mother reacted to that? She could not believe her eyes. She knew that her children were dead, but she walked up to them trying to wake them up. Puta, come on, puta, ne puta, ne puta. And she couldn't touch them because those bodies were so hot. Taking her hands back from time to time because she was too hot. You know, this is melting bodies, that's all. The bodies had begun to melt. I mean, geez, you know, we are talking about lightning strike. 30,000, 40,000 volts in one strike. Usually more than that. The mango tree is on fire and the children just dead. Two children, brother and sister, both young children. So the mother trying to wake the children up. At one point she realizes, they are not going to wake up. Everyone else around, they knew, I mean, what's happened has happened. But the mother is still hopeful. As mothers are, hopeful. Not as mothers are, as minds are. Whenever you want something, you are always hopeful that you can get it. This is the state that you are in right now. You are always hopeful. In the next moment I can get it. And so was that mother. So she's trying to wake her children up, but she realizes they are not going to wake up. Then she becomes unconscious. She falls on the ground. People run up to her and catch her. In a few moments, she regains consciousness. She looks around. Where are my children? She asks. And then she sees her dead children by the tree. And she falls unconscious again. See, this is the mind going unconscious, ladies and gentlemen. You know, when the mind can't bear the grief, the pain, it switches itself off. Because it can't bear that turmoil that's going on right now, in that moment. Because one of two things has to happen. Either she has to go unconscious or she has to go mad. Because the mind has a self-defense mode. It does. When this self-defense mode gets activated, if it does, that mode is called madness. You are not mad yet because your mind has not yet gone into self-defense mode. It is just a flick of a switch. When the mind realizes, what I want can no longer be got. There is no hope of ever getting it. My children are dead. The apple of my eye, they are dead. No hope of ever resurrecting them. There is no point in me living anymore. My whole life was about my children. When the mind realizes there's no hope that I can ever get my children again, the mind switches on its self-defense mode. And when it does that, the mother will now think that she still has her children with her. Isn't that what mad people do? The child is dead, but she thinks she still got the child. Have you not seen mad people in the way they behave? The mother who's gone mad will say, do it again. Go ask Dua to come, please. Where are these children? Now everyone else in the room will know. But the children are dead. No, my children are not dead. What do you think has happened? What the mind can't achieve, it will make believe. That is madness. Proof to you that it is happening and will happen and does happen is Angoda. So why have you not gone mad yet? Because you can still see the carrot hung in front of you. That's why. The carrot is still there ahead of you. If someone ever steals that carrot, then God be with you. In that moment, ladies and gentlemen, you cannot be saved. Patachara was on the verge of going mad. She was on the verge of it. All three of her children lost. Her husband dead. And she came naked, running to the Buddha. Please, I need my child. And the Buddha asked her to sit down and started to preach to her. Helped her to come back to her senses. Because the Buddha is the master of the mind. So he knows what's going to happen now. She was so lucky to confront the Buddha at that moment. But if she went to a psychologist, what do you think they'll do? They say, let me observe your behaviors. Let's run some checks. Book me in for, channel me at this hospital. Come next week, we'll run some checks, we'll have some discussions. And she put the stethoscope, let me see. It's not the mind that goes mad, the chitta goes mad. That's why I speak to you now, because you haven't gone mad yet. Whatever it is you have this craving for, whatever it is you have these attachments for, especially mothers, especially fathers, right? Because once you have children, it's very difficult to save you. You know, it's like they're born out of your own body. You feel you care more about them than you do yourselves. You know this. I also have a mother, so I know what she's like. For them, children is everything. Especially mothers and fathers, right? Yes, you have to do everything you can do for your children, but not at the expense of your own sanity. So especially if you love your mother, if you love your father, and children, if your parents love you very much, bring them here so I can help them. Because lest something happens to you, if something were to happen to you, your mother will go mad because she loves you so much. Love is only a curse in disguise. Love is good for the child. It kills the mother. That's what it does. 9 months of keeping your child in your womb, what did it do to you? Did it not accelerate your death? That burden on your body. And after a mother has, you know, after someone becomes a mother, carrying a child for 9 long months and then feeding your blood and nourishing your child, that kills the mother. You're draining yourself of all energy. Because to stand up another human being, you have to sacrifice a part of yourself. You know, parents need to understand this as well. Sorry, children need to understand this as well. The sacrifices that their mothers have made for them, their fathers have made for them. But at the same time, I need mothers to understand this as well. You know, your love for your child will kill you one day. If it doesn't make you go mad before that. But you don't need love to bring up a child. You just need to help make the child feel that they're loved. There are two things. Very different things. You don't need to have love in your heart towards the child, but you need to help the child feel that they are loved. They're very different things. It's like when you're in a relationship, you don't love someone, but you want to make have them think, you want them to think that they love you, so that you love them. So you pretend. You make pretenses, and you know, so that the other person is always happy. But maybe, you know, you're cheating on them, but you don't reveal that. So you might think, well, isn't that dishonest? Well, if you are willing to sacrifice your sanity for that, then be honest. Love is just another word for attachment. Attachment is the root of all suffering. We have over 100 children at the monastery now, all young children. We love each of them dearly. But not a single tear would shed in my eyes if anything were to happen to them. But we look after them even better than their parents could, because we give them a right upbringing. We show them the noble path. We teach them right from wrong, so that they can stand up on their own two feet, not expecting, not begging, borrowing and stealing happiness from the outside world. But your parents were not able to give you that. That is why to this day you beg, borrow and steal happiness. You have outsourced your happiness. But that's what we do at the monastery. Every young child that comes under our wings. Because this is the duty of the Mahasangha. This is what the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha are for. And this is what I'm doing to you right now as well. In my eyes, your children. You may be older than me. You may have more than me. But I'm happier than you. Because I don't seek my happiness from the outside world. In fact, you can't make me happy. But I have something that will make you happy. So now who's the adult? Who's the parent? A child is always someone who needs nourishing. The parent is the nourisher. So if I have the truth, if I have the message that will help set you free, now who's the parent and who's the child? Once again, I'm not boasting. I'm boasting the Dhamma though. This is what my teachers did with me. So I want all mothers and fathers here particularly to pay attention to what I have to tell you. You haven't gone mad yet, because you can still be hopeful, because the carrot is still hung up there. You can still see the carrot. One of these days, if someone snatches that carrot from you, if it rots, if it falls, and you are now hopeless, when that day comes, you will either almost or you will go mad. So do try and save yourselves before that happens. When that day comes, it's too late. I can't do much, because I'm not the Buddha. I don't know enough to heal a madman. That I don't know. Whether we'll ever be able to do that, I don't know. We're still working out things. We're still trying to figure out the Dhamma. Is there a way we can actually heal a mad person? Someone who's actually gone insane. Can we go and give a sermon at Angoda and help them come back to their senses? We don't know yet. Because for that, ladies and gentlemen, you need to be able to take a drishti. Yeah? You need to be able to take on a drishti. Right now you can take on a drishti because you can make sense of what I'm saying. But once the mind goes insane, it does not have the discipline to make sense of anything. Because every chitta that arises, all it thinks about is the object of its vexation. In every chitta, all they think about is the object of their vexation. So when a person goes mad, they are constantly thinking about that object which they have lost. Constantly. You know, right now you think about something only when, you know, you think about your children when you think about your children. When you're having your meals, you're having your meals, right? You don't think about your children then. But a mind that's gone mad cannot focus on anything else. That's why they can't do the things that you and I can do. That's why they don't behave like normal human beings. Because they're all constantly thinking about that. Have you not seen people who just like talk? And they've gone mad and they just keep on talking, just random things. And sometimes people think they're talking to, like, you know, spirits, and then they take them to a Kattariya to try and, you know, do some black magic and then heal them. But that's not what's happened. They've actually gone mad sometimes. I'm not saying all the time. Some, there are moments, occasions where that sort of thing might happen. But, you know, there are other times where people have actually gone mad. And then they just talk, because what they wanted was someone to be in their lives. And that one person that they wanted in their lives is no more. Perhaps they're dead. But imaginary, an imaginary friend or an imaginary person, an imaginary relation, the mind creates, because the mind is very good at creating things. In fact, everything you see around you is a mental creation. Both physically as well as mentally. They're all creations of the mind. All of these objects came into this world because the mind once conceived it. Everything around here is a conception of the mind initially, and then it takes form. That's how the mind works. When the mind conceives something, it draws on energy. Energy that belongs to the universe. It draws that energy to take these shapes. But we call it a manufacturing process. There's a manufacturing process that brought this into the world. But initially it was a conception in a mind. And then the mind went to action. Because when the mind wants something, it will somehow find a way to get it. If it cannot be achieved in the real world, it will achieve it in a mad world. That's why people go mad. So don't you need refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha? What do you think? Normally, people take refuge when everything is lost. That's when you call them refugees. I urge you to take refuge before you are lost. Take refuge now, before it's too late. Before the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha can't do anything for you. Right now they can. It's time. So one half of a day of your week, I have done what I can. The remaining 6.5 days left to the Mara and his clan, his army. So from the moment you walk out of here, the moment you switch on your mobile phone, right? You know, as soon as the Swaminas finishes sermon, take your mobile phone and see how many messages you received in the meantime. Aren't you coming for this? Aren't you coming for that? Won't you come and watch this with me? Won't you come and do that with me? Mara. The Mara's clan. Trying to interest you and invite you and indulge you in as many sensual pleasures as possible. These are all carrots. Remember, it's always a donkey that's behind the carrot. I don't think I need to spell it out to you. I care about you people. That's why I come and speak to you. My advice is to stay at home. The advice I got from my doctor. Apparently I'm not supposed to speak. But I know if I don't do that, what hope do you have, at least, you know, for the next week? Who's going to come and share this? Will you go and watch the online sermon from yesterday? As if. So now I have to do two sermons, one at the monastery and one here. And if it's a poya day, then I have to do two at the monastery and one here. But I do it because I care. I told you, when I look at you, I know I have here parents from my previous births. All of you have been mothers and fathers to me, and you'll have gone all the way to help me become a human being today. You'll have done whatever you can and whatever was in your power. So it's now my turn to repay that debt to you. But I need you to do what you have to do. I will do what I have to do. This is not a battle I can win by myself. To shake hands, I'll put my hand forward always. It'll always be there. If you want to shake hands, you got to come up and you got to extend your hand, and then we shake hands. Because the Buddha has forbidden us from going after people and preaching to them. That is forbidden. I can't go running after you and say, Ani Nona, please come and listen to some sermon, Nona. I can't do that. It is forbidden. If I could, I would. But I think the reason that he's laid down that code of discipline is because that way the Dhamma never sticks with you. If you don't have respect and regard towards the Dhamma will never stick. Because the Dhamma is something so pure. It's the most sublime thing. This is the truth. And the heart, the mind should be pure. Then like attracts like. That's the way it works. This is the law of attraction again. Your mind should be pure. That's why we say don't engage in unmeritorious deeds. Give up all the unmeritorious deeds. Because if you defile your mind, if you defile your heart with unmeritorious deeds, killing, stealing, lying, all this stuff, sensual misconduct, you know the 10 unmeritorious deeds. If you keep doing them, and if you keep doing this vasalagati, right? If you keep doing that sort of thing, your mind is not pure enough for the Dhamma to take root. Because the Dhamma is pure. So for like to attract like, your mind should become as pure as the Dhamma. Then the mind, then the Dhamma is drawn. Otherwise these are just words. You will hear the words. You will understand the logic. But it won't plant. It won't set in. It just float. Like dust floating in air. It will never settle. For it to settle, you have to be virtuous internally. That's why if you lead a double life, one here and different one at home, believe you me, the Dhamma won't do anything for you. So you're very virtuous when you come here. I'm not suggesting for one bit that you are so, I'm just saying, and this is just good advice. If you lead a good life here, when you're here, you're very virtuous, you're very kind and generous. But outside, when you're with your family, when you're with your friends, remember, I always tell you, the best way to check whether you have understood the Dhamma is by asking the people who you live with, not here, not by me giving you a test in the Parichasamuppada. That's not how you check it. Ask the people who you live with, am I a better person to you? Am I a better husband to you? Am I a better wife to you? Am I a better son and a better daughter? Do you feel it has become easier for you to work with me? Or am I still headstrong? If I think of something, I have to do it my way and no other way. Do I still get very angry whenever I can't get it my way? That is the acid test. I tell you to respect your parents. All of these help and support for the mind to be cleansed enough so that the Dhamma can take root. This is why this is a pratipada. So just listening to the Dhamma will not enable you to attain Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen. You'll understand the Dhamma. That's a different matter. To understand the Dhamma, you just need a lecture. I mean, in fact, I could give you a book. Go read this. Reading the Tripitaka will not help you become an arahant, let alone a sotapanna. You can't read a Tripitaka and become a sotapanna. Because that requires a practice. The practice of purifying your mind. Dropping those things that are unvirtuous and filling your heart with the things that are virtuous. Doing the meritorious deeds, being kind to others, being gentle to others, having gratitude in your heart. Those were the things we talked about at the beginning of our talks, if you remember. That was setting the ground for the Dhamma to take root. You know, I'm doing the job of a farmer. If you are my land, I have the seed. First, I have to fertilize the ground, the land. First, it needs to be fertile ground before I throw the seeds. And otherwise, you know, there's no point in throwing the seeds. Even if this is the most potent seed, if the land is not ready, then it's pointless. That's why meritable deeds, meritorious deeds, these are all extremely supportive and helpful. And you need them in your lives. So do as many of them as possible. If you want to attain Nibbana one day, someday, this is the path. Not the middle path. This is the path. But if you do what I ask you to do, not I personally, if you do what the Mahasangha wants you to do, if you do as the Buddha advised you to do, then there is no stopping you either. You cannot be stopped. Because there is no you doing it. That's why you cannot be stopped. This is a process. Once you start the process, as long as there are causes that drive that process will lead to its final destination. If something falls from the sky, how long can you stop it from falling, hitting the ground? One day, it will hit the ground. Maybe you can hold your hand up like this and collect the water and not let it fall onto the ground. But how long can you hold this like this? One day, you're going to have to let go, right? On that day, it's going to drop onto the ground. In the same manner, if you start falling, in other words, if you start this path to Nibbana and you have the right causes, then there is no stopping you. You will attain Nibbana. Because it is not you who is attaining Nibbana. There is no doer here, just the done. Nibbana will be done. It's not you doing it. Just as much as suffering is done, it's not you who is suffering. Suffering is done. But more on that later. Alright, let's conclude for today then. Let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired to those who are deserving of these merits, and particularly those who have helped and supported and assisted us to engage in this meritorious deed. So first and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasikas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters, who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, as well as my Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the other monks resident at the monastery, and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who contribute to the construction of the monastery, to those who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. Let us also transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employees and our employees, as well as our teachers and those who helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcoming obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to protecting and fulfilling the Sambhudasasana. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. And by the power of these merits, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great sacrifices for the peace and harmony of our nation. This includes the members of the armed forces, as well as the police force, as well as those who lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives from natural disasters such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, blizzards, pandemics and the likes. May they all rejoice in these merits, reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us. They will have gone the extra mile. They would have shed blood, sweat and tears on our behalf. Being grateful towards them and with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness, let us transfer all these merits that we have acquired to all of them. By the power of these merits, If any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plain. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success become a arahatan vahanse or an arahatiranin vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnam midatnva Dvesha ginnam midatnva Moha ginnam midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Raga gini mileva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan sapala deva Nivan sapala deva Nivan sapala deva
Tundranghe Susi Ananta Mahaguna Belen Siru Loka Siru Satyoma Nibbana Paramasukhen Sukhita Taravetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.